Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, why the Trump administration is leaning on influencers to help patrol the southern border, and how one man's story of an alien abduction has defined his life. But first, on the eve of Independence Day, America and its many definitions are top of mind. And so, at a time when the nature of patriotism is a subject of intense debate, we wanted to have a conversation with somebody who defines himself as a patriot, but defies easy definitions himself. Steve May is an Army veteran, a Republican, former state legislature. He's also a gay man who marched in the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. He's got a lot to say about what patriotism means to him, and he joins me now. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. It's a great day to be an American in the desert, especially after a night of rain.
Amen. Well, so I understand, Steve, that your niece recently asked you what patriotism is.
So my 14-year-old niece who lives in Kenya, and she's lived in Kenya her whole life. She was born there. Her parents were both American. I said I was going to come here and talk about patriotism, and she said, well, what is patriotism?
Yeah.
And I said, let me look it up first so I don't misdirect you here. But of course, it's love of country.
Yeah.
But for me, country means this physical space that we are in, all of the people in it, and the idea that the country is. Like, what are the values and the ideas that make America unique?
Mm-hmm.
So that's country for me, and I do love America.
Yeah.
And America has given me great opportunities and put me through some hell, too.
Sure.
But what a ride.
Yeah. Well, so you did something that I think many people would agree is one of the core tenets of patriotism, which is that you served in the Army. Tell me, what made you decide to do that?
Well, as I say to people, I got more than I gave. I loved what I learned in the Army, the people that I met, and what I was able to accomplish. You know, I joined the military. I was inspired, actually, by John McCain to join the military. Started, actually, the Navy ROTC program. Spent 2 months underwater in a submarine and said, I think I'd rather be in the Army. So I switched to the Army. And then I ended up as a nuclear, biological, and chemical defense officer in a mechanized infantry division. And I joined the military like a lot of people did because it gave me a way out of a difficult family situation, and it paid for college.
Yeah.
And so I was able to go to college. I would not have – it paid for my college entirely. So the American taxpayers, you know, gave me a great gift, and in return, I served in the military.
Yeah. But – this was also at a time when, in order to be in the military, you ostensibly also had to deny a core part of who you were.
So I joined in 1989 when I was 17. I didn't know who I was.
Mm.
And back then, there was a ban on gays serving in the military. Then in 1993, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was implemented. Right before I got commissioned a month after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was implemented. So I started at 17, and then at 21, I knew I was gay, but I thought Don't Ask, Don't Tell allowed me to kind of walk that fine line. Well, okay, I can be gay. I just can't tell anybody that I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not a real life. Like, that's not possible. You can't live and work in a military situation and lie to your peers all the time. Because they'll say, what'd you do last weekend? Oh, I can't talk. I have to separate my friend groups. I have to hide who I'm hanging out with. Like, it isn't possible to live that lie.
Yeah. So how do you navigate that with the McCain-inspired feelings that prompted you to want to be a part of the military in the first place?
Well, for me, I felt that, remember, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was congressionally mandated. You know, Clinton negotiated, congressionally mandated. It was not like innate to military fact that gay people couldn't serve. Gay people have always been in the military.
Right.
So I believe, look, that law is wrong. That law is wrong.
Uh-huh.
It's not really, and I always believed that law was fundamentally in conflict with what it means to be an American and what we're trying to do in this country, like equal opportunity, fairness, and justice for all. That law was in conflict with it. So I was able to say, that law is wrong. I'm right. I can serve.
Okay.
So in my mind, I allowed myself to serve. But of course, I did not understand. I mean, the Army actually had investigators searching for gay people. They would go to gay bars and go to gay places. They would search for gay people in the military so they could harass them and kick them out.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't envisioned when that policy was first imagined, but that's right. What happened. They were called witch hunts. We called them witch hunts. So I left the military as soon as I was allowed to.
Uh-huh.
And then I got called because I didn't want to go through a prosecution process, which is what eventually happened. I got out. Then I became an openly gay Republican elected official, one of the first in the country, and then nationally known. And then the Army called me back in and then started the process of prosecuting me, kicking me out, which is exactly what I had tried to avoid.
Kicking you out for saying that you were gay.
For saying that I'm gay. And so...
Even though you had already served.
Even though I'd already served, and I already said it. And then they called me back in afterwards. So it was kind of this great case. And I was a state legislator and nationally known. And so I had kind of a voice that most people serving in the military did not have.
Yeah.
And so when they came after me, I felt like, they gave me the option to resign and quietly walk away. And I said, hell no, you're wrong. Like, this law is wrong, and I'm going to show the American public that this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to make you prosecute me. I'm going to make you investigate me. I'm going to make you prove the evidence. Prove to the world that I am gay and that I said that I'm gay. And they did all that, and I went to trial for 2 days. The whole process was miserable.
Uh-huh.
But at the end of this two-day period, they determined, like, I am now a convicted homosexual. Just think about that. From 2000, from September 2000, like 25 years ago, the American government made me a convicted homosexual, right?
Yeah.
But I was able to tell this story to the American public. I forced the Army to tell their dirt. It wasn't the Army, it's Congress, right?
Right.
The Army loved me. Uh-huh. Like, the institution prosecuted me because Congress told them they had to. But every single person I worked with in the Army loved me.
Yeah.
And I loved them. So I forced this ugly story to be told. And the American public then listened and said, this doesn't make any sense. This is wrong. Why are we going after that kid?
Right.
Like, that kid just wants to serve. He's doing a good job.
So, like, Steve, I have to say, I mean, we just have like 30 seconds left. What is your message to somebody who might be listening to this who has a similar story where they feel like they believe in America, but America is telling them a story that they don't belong?
It's not true. Know that. It's not true. Share your story. Talk to your fellow American. The person who disagrees with you, the person who thinks you don't belong, talk to them. Throughout the history of this country, when we engage other Americans, they change their opinions. They listen. If we listen, they listen, and we have won. We've won on issues of race, of gender, on LGBT issues. We win. When we talk, when we engage, we win.
Steve May, thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
And happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th.
New research raises the question of whether living within a few miles of a golf course increases your risk of developing Parkinson's disease. Dr. Brittany Krzyzanowski is an assistant professor at Barrow Neurological Institute and worked on this study. She says prior research focused on whether living near a golf course increased cancer risks. The main connection between these two areas of study is pesticides. Krzyzanowski says there's a well-known link between pesticides and Parkinson's disease, but little research into the relationship between the neurological disease and golf courses. The data that exists has found, among other things, a pattern of pesticide-related cancers in golf course superintendents. Krzyzanowski says these new results, which were published in JAMA, seem to show some similarities with those previous studies.
Yes, so that is the case. And, if I could go a little further into what inspired this work, beyond those prior studies, there's been tons of other studies that looked into the ability of pesticides to leach into groundwater supplies. And then there was also this incident in Cape Cod where the groundwater under four different golf courses was contaminated with pesticides, with one of the pesticides being present in the drinking water at levels more than 200 times greater than the health guidance level.
How strong is the relationship? I mean, can we say for sure that pesticides used on golf courses potentially leaking into groundwater is the cause of some number of these people to end up developing Parkinson's?
Absolutely not. At this point, this study, it's important to remind everybody who's reading the study that one of the major limitations is that we didn't have data on pesticide usage. We didn't take water samples or samples from the individuals, so we're limited in how we can interpret these results.
So what do you then take them to mean? Or maybe more to the point, what would you like to be looking at next to really get a sense of what's going on here?
I mean, I guess I would say I would like to, remind everyone about the strengths of the study, perhaps. So the strengths of the studies would be that we were using this population-based data set for the study area, and we used address-level data. We also had accurate data on golf course locations, and we could accurately determine the source of everyone's drinking water, whether that be city water or well water. So we did have a strong study in those regards, with the major limitation being that we didn't have data on pesticide usage. In terms of, what we want to do for next steps, we hope to replicate this study in the future, nationwide. So there would be some challenges there. In particular, we need to draw the boundaries around tens of thousands of golf courses nationwide in order to have these precise distance measures. But we have a good start on that so far.
And just to be clear, am I right that this study did not look at the Phoenix area, which of course has a lot of golf courses in it?
That's correct. So this study was limited to a region in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And it's important to note that this region has hot and humid summers where golf courses might have applied pesticides with more frequency compared to other geographic regions. So, our results might not generalize to other areas. In particular, the desert southwest where Phoenix is, prior studies have suggested that these drier climates apply less pesticides to golf courses compared to the hot and humid parts of the Midwest.
Do golf courses tend to use different kinds of pesticides than, for example, parks, which also have, lots of grass, or sports stadiums or other places like that that also have a lot of grass that they'd like to keep green?
I'm not comfortable with answering that, but I do know that there's a lot of overlap between the pesticides used in golf courses, the pesticides used in agriculture, and in, sports fields.
So does that mean that it maybe wouldn't shock you if you found similar kinds of results for people who maybe live within a certain distance from a stadium or from a farm or something like that?
Yeah, so in terms of the farm, we've done previous research on agricultural farms, and we found an association between, how much farm fields, like the density of farm fields in your neighborhood and your risk of Parkinson's, and that was particularly high in the Great Plains region of the United States. In terms of, did you say sports fields?
Yeah, like
Was
a
that?
maybe like a baseball stadium or a soccer field or something like that.
There are some kind of anecdotal reports on that. I can't go into it though, but I know some people who have written on the potential for that.
So, given, as you say, sort of the strengths and some of the, information that maybe we don't have based on this study, what to you should people reading this take away from it?
I think that it's important to, to realize that, yes, this is an observational study, so we cannot make causal conclusions from our results. But this is a good first step towards understanding the potential for environmental toxins applied to the places that we visit, the places that are around us, the golf courses, for example, that these may have the potential to impact our health.
And how much do we understand the relationship between pesticides in general and Parkinson's? Like, do we know why there might be a relationship there?
Yeah, so there's tons of research on the link between pesticides and Parkinson's, including animal models, epidemiological models, and occupational studies as well. So it's generally widely accepted that pesticides are linked to Parkinson's disease risk. I think it's also important to note that Parkinson's disease develops many decades after exposure. So our study is interested in is estimating exposure that occurred many years ago. So, if pesticides are involved in our association, they would have been the ones that were sprayed a long time ago, and that might be different from what's being sprayed today.
All right. That is Dr. Brittany Krasinowski with Barrow Neurological Institute. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And that conversation with Dr. Krasinowski brought to you by my co-host, Mark Brody. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how one Arizona couple brought an anthropological lens to UFO research.
They spent their life together pursuing this passion, studying UFOs. They were pioneers in the field and, no surprise, you know, suffered a lot of ridicule, at least in some corners.
We'll hear the story of the founders of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. But first, the Trump administration's aggressive push to step up the pace of deportations has created renewed scrutiny, of the murky boundaries between law enforcement, private security firms, and local militias, all of which have been deputized by the administration to help apprehend migrants at the border. Jessica Pishko wrote about this recently for The New Yorker, and she joins me now. Jessica, good morning.
Hi, good to hear from you.
Yes, yes. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your reporting on this. You start your piece by introducing us to somebody named Christy Hutcherson. Tell us about Christy.
So Christy Hutcherson is a woman from Texas. She has claimed to have a variety of experiences in Homeland Security. So one of the reasons I focused on her, I think, first of all, because many people think about this militia security, Homeland Security space is largely male, and she's one of the few females in this category. But she also plays an interesting role in that she's both media and expert, right? So she goes down to the border and films videos for her followers,
right,
in which she uses a lot of very sophisticated equipment and then sort of claims to produce this material that reflects, I think, what a lot of people on the right, but also in the center, view as a kind of, you know, quote unquote, border crisis.
Yeah. Well, and this phenomenon of folks like Christy is reflective of a broader trend, right, where the idea of private security and militias has existed for a long time, but now there's this sort of influencer element to Border Patrol.
That's right. So the influencer element is certainly far and wide. If anyone goes on TikTok or Twitter, right, they will find thousands and thousands of videos from kind of amateur media groups who, you know, with the equipment that we all have on our cell phones, can now go down to the U.S.-Mexico border and film, you know, summer like camps for that nonprofits set up that give people like water and a place to shower, that, you know, you can go and film like Border Patrol encounters with immigrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. So I think like the advent of all this easily available equipment also produces a lot of visuals that, you know, are also edited. So what happens is these influencers tend to edit the videos to make things look the most foreboding as they can.
Right, right. Because we should say, as I think I saw Chiron on the news this morning, actual border crossings are extremely low right now, right? Despite what some of these videos might make it seem like.
Yes, they're very low right now. And if anyone is looking online at these videos through the various streamers, what they will actually find is that all the videos right now on Twitter are old. So many of them were filmed, you know, in 2022, which was kind of the height of border crossings when Joe Biden was president. So what they do is take these videos and then recycle them to suggest that they are more recent.
So I also wanted to ask you about, you cite a sociologist in your piece named, I believe it's Harel Shapira, who did a study of militias and groups like the ones that we're talking about to try to understand what fuels them, and talked about, among other things, a, quote, sense of meaninglessness. What was interesting to you about this work?
So one of the things that Professor Shapira did was he, you know, his book was more of a case study, so not necessarily data driven, but he went down to the border and spent time with these people. So just to be clear that this is the kind of work he was doing. But what he found was that when he talked to people, that their motivations for joining groups like the border militia were not necessarily all, I think, based in a sense of racism, right, or a desire to like enact violence on people. but rather these were folks looking for meaning, looking for a way to be patriotic in a sense, right? This sort of connects, I think, to a lot of images and things floating around about, you know, issues of men feeling alienated from society,
right,
kind of looking for a place to fit in.
Right.
I was going to say we aren't at war. We weren't at war. So now that these sort of, you know, never ending wars have theoretically ended, there's a lot of people who I think are looking for both excitement, right? The kind of like thrill of being in a place that's perceived to be wild, the excitement of like videoing things that might be forbidden or that people, you know, maybe they're not supposed to see it.
Right.
And again, and like I said, just the sense that like they're doing something very good, even though he points out in his book that these people he spent time with, they actually encountered very, very few actual immigrants.
Right.
So even then, like this has been a consistent trend, is that they spent a lot of time looking and looking, but actually encountered very few people.
But a difference, it seems like now, is that whereas groups like this have existed for a long time and perhaps have implicitly collaborated with federal agencies, now that connection is more explicit under the Trump administration, correct?
Yes. I mean, it's hard to say. So, you know, I want to be clear, because there's also a lot of online rumors going around about some ICE agents may or may not be like Jan Sixers, or they may or may not be militia members, right?
Right.
So I want to be clear and say that, like, we don't have evidence at this time to suggest that Trump has actually deputized militias, like Proud Boys, to go and do immigration enforcement. But one of the things that is true is that this is sort of an interlocking universe, right? Like, if you thought about the Venn diagram, like the kind of people who become ICE agents or Border Patrol intersects with the kind of people who join militias, intersects with the kind of people who do this private security work. And private security, of course, has a lower barrier to entry than joining the Department of Homeland Security. It's a lot less training, you know, there's fewer hoops to jump through. And so that tends to be a place where a lot of people who might not qualify to join law enforcement, right, will do private security.
Yeah.
So it kind of becomes like, what are those loopholes? I mean, it's not unlike, you know, it's not unlike Blackwater or like the kind of military contractors overseas, right? They absorb people who have separated from the military or are like not qualified to be in the military.
All right. Well, we will have to leave it there for today. That is Jessica Pishko, who wrote about this for The New Yorker. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. In the 1940s and 1950s, there was a dramatic rise in news reports and personal accounts of encounters with UFOs and extraterrestrials. The flying saucer craze, as it came to be known, took root in cities and towns all over the country. Groups of concerned and/or fascinated citizens would get together to swap articles and stories from their own experience. In Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, a woman named Coral Lorenzen had a UFO encounter of her own, and she told her husband Jim about it. Eventually, the two of them immersed themselves in the growing community of flying saucer enthusiasts. And the more they read up on the subject, the more they felt like there was a bit of a disconnect. Clearly, there was widespread interest in learning more about the growing number of reported sightings, but the conversations felt diffuse and disorganized. So Jim and Coral decided to do something about that. In 1952, they launched the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, or APRO. The idea was to become a centralized clearinghouse for everything UFO: personal stories, evidence of military research on UFOs, reports from local newspapers and magazines about unexplained encounters. In 1960, Jim and Coral moved APRO to Tucson, Arizona. Now, in the world of UFO enthusiasts, APRO's work is legendary. But for decades, their archives were inaccessible. Until a couple years ago, when David Marler, the executive director of the National UFO Historical Records Center, worked out a deal to bring the archives to New Mexico, where the center is located, and put them on public display. Marler has examined every word in the Lorenzen's archives, and he says that while the word pioneer is overused, in the case of Jim and Coral's work with APRO, it's the truth.
for the most part, the organizations that had existed before, and I use that term loosely, it was usually just social clubs, would probably be a better descriptive. They were rather parochial in nature. You might have a small group in Portland, Oregon. You might have a small group in Des Moines, Iowa. And they would all just talk amongst themselves about articles in the newspaper and magazines, and maybe local sightings as well that had occurred. What Jim and Coral did was create a nationwide network. They not only collected reports, they not only managed a team of investigators, they also, you know, issued a bi-monthly newsletter. They lectured across the country. They wrote numerous books on the subject. They were compelled and driven by much what I am compelled and driven by. And that is not just, you know, promoting the mystery of the UFO subject, but truly trying to gain answers. And the only way we're going to do that is by bringing puzzle pieces together in the form of case files, news reports, military accounts. The more data we have, arguably with regard to any subject that you're studying, the better off you're going to be.
And what do we know about Jim and Coral's ultimate goal?
They were very patriotic Americans, Jim and Coral Lorenzen. In fact, for a time period before they moved to Tucson, Arizona, they were actually based at Alamogordo, New Mexico, and both worked at Holloman Air Force Base and established really great ties with scientists, engineers, and military personnel. No surprise, that's how they obtained a lot of the UFO reports, was by being at Holloman and hearing about local sightings by military personnel, engineers, etc. So they weren't anti-government. And so I think their primary goal, really, in retrospect, was to educate the American public on with regard to the UFO subject.
That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that, David, because it aligns with a general sense I have in looking into Jim and Coral. And I wonder if you could confirm this, that they don't really seem to have been ideologues or, as you said, like anti-government conspiracy theorists necessarily. It almost seems sort of ethnographic.
Yes. And I think they felt to some degree, and again, I can't speak with certainty, but again, when you look at their correspondence, you read their books, I think that they felt that there was a social responsibility.
Well, this makes me think of a pair of quotes from Coral that I'd love to get your perspective on that I found really interesting and different from what one might expect. She said, quote, "We do not pretend to know the source or the substance of these objects," referring to UFOs. "We just know that all these people surely could not have been having hallucinations, especially when groups of people all report the same observations." And for me, that sounds like something an anthropologist would say. Like, there is clearly some sort of social phenomenon happening here. Why wouldn't we want to investigate it?
Absolutely. And people ask me, "So you believe in all this?" And I pause and I look at them and I say, I don't summarily believe all of this, but at the same time, as an educated, objective individual, I can't summarily discount all of this.
Well, that makes me think of the other Coral quote I wanted to, or I actually don't know if this was Jim or Coral, but at one point, somebody asked them to weigh in on whether they really thought there was any such thing as a UFO. And they said, "Even if there is no such thing as a UFO, quote, many people throughout the world then must be suffering from some sort of mental aberration, which is an equally disturbing thought."
Absolutely. Which requires additional research. And I often say, whether you relegate UFOs to fact, fiction, or folklore, it should be an area of focus. Jim and Coral, one of the individuals that they corresponded with in the 1950s was Dr. Carl Jung. And Jung had a fascination with regard to the subject and, of course, wrote a book on the subject, Flying Saucers. And Jung looked at it purely through a psychological perspective. He really states in the letters that I've looked at to Jim and Coral that he's not a physicist. He can't speak to the physical reality, but much to what you were alluding to, that there is an experience that people are having. And he was trying to look at it through the lens of psychology.
In a similar vein to what we've been talking about, another quote of theirs that I found really interesting is when they were asked how they felt about the fact that the CIA was evidently monitoring APRO and its members. They said, again, quoting, "This is fine. They'd be derelict in their duty if they didn't. We don't resent this at all, and we'd be pleased if they asked to see our files.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was Jim and Coral. Again, they weren't anti-establishment, anti-government. And in fact, it's ironic because I can't remember the date of that quote, but decades later, because I think that was from the 1950s or 60s, but decades later, we actually got the declassified Robertson Panel meeting notes. The Robertson Panel was a Washington, D.C. think tank group that was established in January 53. It was called the Robertson Panel, named after H.P. Robertson, a leading physicist at the time, sponsored by the CIA. And one of the recommendations stated that they should spy on UFO organizations and UFO groups.
And do we know what the reason for that surveillance was? Did the CIA think that groups like APRO were, I don't know, in cahoots with the Soviet Union?
Yes. Yes. To be quite honest, unlike APRO, there were some smaller UFO organizations and groups that did have a lot of anti-government rhetoric.
Right.
And a lot of it was also tied at the time. There's the UFO contactee movement. This was a group of individuals and groups that claimed that they were in touch with space beings and that people were coming from Venus and other planets to warn us about the ills of atomic testing and atomic weapons.
But it seems like from what we've been talking about and some other things I was reading, that Jim and Coral and APRO in general was consciously trying to stand in contrast to groups.
Absolutely.
that had that sort of approach.
Yes. And unlike a lot of people in the UFO subject today, Jim and Coral Lorenzen did not do this for money. Yes, they issued a newsletter. Yes, they wrote books, but they in no way, shape, or form ever came close to compensating themselves for the time and money that they invested. You know, Jim and Coral were husband and wife, and they spent their life together, but they spent their life together pursuing this passion, studying UFOs. They were pioneers in the field, and no surprise, you know, suffered a lot of ridicule, at least in some corners. When they were dying, Jim passed away in 86 and Coral passed away in 88. Their wish was, we want this material to be available to the general public, and we don't want people to charge for it. 13 file cabinets and 50 boxes of APRO material.
Wow. Which you now have there at the National UFO Historical Records Center.
We do. In June of 2024, we solidified a partnership with the Rio Rancho Public School System, who saw value in the history that we were compiling, and they provided building space and grounds for us to expand and create a public-facing archive. And it's been an incredible partnership. The school system is not here to promote belief in UFOs or aliens, but they do appreciate the history that's tied to Arizona, New Mexico, and many other southwestern states. But we're using the UFO subject as a vehicle, a Trojan horse, if I can use that term, to engage students, but in the process, teach them about physics, military history, you know, engineering like radar. How does radar operate? Critical thinking skills, the investigative process, how to be objective, witness credibility, all of these things. And it's an interesting social experiment that both the school system and our organization have undertaken. And in large part due to the APRO files, we now have the largest collection of historical UFO case files that has ever been assembled in the history of the United States.
Well, David Marler is the executive director of the National UFO Historical Records Center, which houses the complete archives of APRO, founded by Jim and Coral Lorenzen. David, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Well, Arizona wasn't just home to one of the most seminal UFO research projects. It was also the site of one of the most famous reported abductions. In 1975, Travis Walton was working on a logging crew in a forest on the Mogollon Rim near the tiny town of Heber-Overgaard in the central part of the state. According to Walton, who was 22 at the time, on the night of November 5th, he encountered the blinding light of a UFO in a clearing in the forest. The other members of the logging crew said they fled the scene in terror to go get help, and when they came back, Travis was gone. Walton was missing for days. And then, around midnight on November 12th, the phone rang at Walton's sister's house. It was Travis, and he said he'd been abducted by aliens. Walton's story became national news. He was interviewed extensively by, among others, Jim Lorenzen of APRO. Lorenzen later gave his own interview about his conversation with Travis.
Well, I was struck by the fact that he described these beings that didn't look quite human. He described them precisely the way another person has described them who had a similar experience. Now, this case has not been published anywhere, and no case like it that I know of has been published. So it's something that Travis could not have read anywhere.
Travis went on to write a book, which was later adapted into a film called Fire in the Sky. And while numerous questions have been raised about the veracity of the story Walton and his fellow loggers told, he has never wavered. In 2015, filmmaker Jennifer Stein made a documentary about Travis Walton that she hoped would counter the attempts to debunk Walton's account. For the last few years, they've been traveling the country together, giving talks, and I reached out to them to talk about what it's like to stick to a story that so many people simultaneously want to believe and want to disprove. Travis told me he's a little sick of it.
Rather, it never happened.
Why is that?
Well, you know, it's continually having to prove myself. And,
right.
And, you know, it wasn't anything that I could have foreseen and desired as a part of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, how did you first become interested in Travis's story?
Well, I knew Travis's story, but when I finally got to meet him and I realized how genuine he was, I realized nobody had ever bothered to do a decent documentary about his case. There was the Fire in the Sky, Paramount Pictures film that mm-hmm. really kind of sort of told the story, but changed it and mm-hmm. made it, you know, a horror, scary story, especially the onboard the craft experiences mm-hmm. that Travis had. And it really didn't legitimize any of what these boys had been through. And I had my own UFO encounter as well. So I had a lot of respect for what they'd been through uh-huh. and for the ridicule they'd been through. And I just felt somebody really needed to tell their story.
Travis, if I'm not mistaken, one of the things that must be difficult in terms of giving people the story they might want about this is, as I understand it from Jennifer's film, your memories of what actually happened, there's not that much to them, right? I mean, you have a memory of being up in this craft. You have a memory of seeing this figure in a helmet. But it seems like that's kind of all there is to it, right? It's not as though there's enough there for like a feature length.
I was unconscious or dead most of those days. As far as the overall picture, you have seven people mm-hmm. testifying and staying by their story for all these years. Mm-hmm. And if you had seven people testifying that they had witnessed a murder, I mean, even without polygraph tests, you would have an extremely airtight case,
sure.
but only because it involves this particular subject that people continue to try to find cracks in it, mm-hmm. Which they don't.
Well, can I ask you, Travis, I mean, you've now been talking about this experience for 50 years. I'm sure people have said all kinds of things to you over the years, but I'd love to know, what are some of the things that have stayed with you over all the decades of talking about this? The most unique things people have brought
up? Probably, you know, is my perception of these beings' intentions was extremely negative at the time. But over the years, I've realized that the intention was to save my life.
And just to say, for people who haven't seen Jennifer's film, that's a very remarkable moment in the film where you say basically, and please correct me if I have this wrong, that you have come to this interpretation that you got swept up in the beam from this craft that you say you had seen, and that the reason they took you into the craft was to treat your wounds, basically.
Yeah, and, you know, I was probably mortally wounded, and that saved my life.
One of the other things that the film talks about is the idea that after this happened, you were likely experiencing some symptoms of trauma, and that that was one of the reasons that it was hard for you to speak out about it initially, to speak coherently about it. And those are obviously things that are much better understood now than they were back when this happened. Jennifer, from your perspective, and if you'd care to speak about your own experience, did you relate to that? Is that one of the reasons you wanted to feature that in the film?
Mine was in September of 1975. So it was before Travis's event. And it was a rectangle of white light that was 90 feet long and about 6 feet high and made absolutely no sense at all. And it was less than 500 feet away from me, sort of in the middle of forest land in Pennsylvania, Mennonite forest land where my parents' house was. And for 25 years, I didn't really talk about it because I thought I was the only one that saw it. And I wasn't quite sure it wasn't the tail end of a dream or if it really happened or what. And then 25 years later, the person who was at my house at the time, who I knew very well, was visiting me, and he saw the same thing I saw, and he was asleep on the other leg of the house, another floor of the house. He saw the same thing I saw at 5:30 in the morning. And we never talked about it at the time. But 25 years later, this friend said, "What happened? Like, do you remember that?" And I was like, "Wow."
Travis, how much do you feel, you know, at this point, there is less skepticism, I think it's fair to say, about the idea of unidentified objects in the skies, thanks to some declassifications that have happened over the past few years. But obviously, a significant difference in your story versus the stories that other people have about just sightings is that your story is one of actual abduction and of seeing other beings. How much do you feel like that has differentiated your experience from other folks who have had UFO encounters?
I think that is a critical factor, that I don't think it was an intentional abduction. Now, in hindsight, thinking that my injury is what necessitated me being taken aboard. They were the only ones in a position to rescue me. And, you know, they could have covered it up. They could have just dumped me on some asteroid somewhere and never, you know, left it up to the crew to be under suspicion of murder forever.
And I should just say, for listeners who aren't as familiar with the story, the other folks who were working on the logging crew that you were a part of, Travis, during the 5 days or so during which you were missing, there was some suspicion that those other folks on the crew had been involved in your death. But obviously, once it turned out you were alive, those suspicions went away.
Yes, cover up for a murder, but that was not the case.
One of the other things that comes out in the film is this stat that 1 in 10 people who say they've had UFO encounters report those encounters. Is part of what you're hoping for to encourage more people who've had these experiences to talk about them?
Sure. The more people can deal with their issues, their trauma, no matter what it is, the better. This is one of those things that's usually the most profound experience someone has, and they often feel like they can't talk about it with anybody. And yet they're really turned on or lit up by it. Their lives are catapulted by it because their mind is opened up, their consciousness is shifted and changed, and they want to try to understand it and put it into perspective with a bigger understanding. You know, I just encourage people not to let it freak them out or destroy their lives, but to find a place to have compassion for themselves and put it in the framework of their fuller understanding of the nature of reality.
And it sounds like, if I'm hearing you right, Jennifer, one of the things that you are advocating for is that in speaking about one's experience, something that you can get out of that is to find community, even if you might not necessarily get an answer to what happens in your own experience.
Yes, correct. And many people look at going to UFO conferences as one of the most enlightening things to do, because you can kind of talk about almost anything at a UFO conference, because once you're at that level of discussion, you're not really going to freak people out very much, you know?
Right. So it can be a gateway to other things.
Correct, exactly.
Well, I do have to ask you both. I was reading about in 2021, Travis, one of the guys who was on that logging crew that you were with told a film producer in this recorded phone call that the abduction was a hoax. He later retracted that story. I imagine that must have been a complicated experience for you. What do you make of that whole situation?
Well, you know, there was powerful jealousies involved. And, you know, these guys would come out and speak with me. And then people would rush right by them and ignore them and talk to me. And, you know, after what they'd been through and the emotional impact it had on them, I can understand the jealousy. What happened was a dishonest investigator came to him and said, Travis is getting ready to tell me the whole story was all made up, but I just can't meet his price. Can you match him? And that was how he leveraged Mike to get Mike to say that it never happened, because he thought I was betraying us all by just being willing to say it didn't happen for the right price, which was not true. I did not say any such thing to him. I told him to buzz off, and, you know, that was the end of it. He had tricked Mike into believing that I was going to claim it didn't happen just for money.
I see. Well, I mean, I guess what's interesting to me about all this is less the question of, you know, who has their facts straight and who doesn't, but the fact that after all these years and everything that has come out, it seems like these questions still give people such strong emotional reactions. Like, this is still something that people feel so strongly about.
Either the facts can guide us to our conclusions, or we have some strong emotional thing that we wish was true, and we'll grab at anything to support it. Mm-hmm. And that's just a human frailty that we see everywhere you look. Mm-hmm. You know, they come up with a conclusion and then look for a way to justify it.
Well, Jennifer Stein is a filmmaker and Travis Walton is an author. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of stories on the show today about patriotism and the nature of belief. Whatever story you tell yourself about America, we hope that you are able to celebrate safely and proudly tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Happy Independence Day. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you next week.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.